Good morning, and thank you again for joining me here for this service. Reverend Alex has been doing an enlightening sermon series on the six sources of Unitarian Universalism, and it occurred to me that exploring the implications of the seven UU principles might also be a good exercise. It's something we often refer to, but I don't know how often we really sit and think about what it actually is, what we're actually affirming, right? And so I think it's good to do that. My hope is that one of our other speakers will develop a service around each of the seven principles over the next year or so. And today, I'll ask us to consider the first UU principle. Before I start, I should note that Unitarian Universalism is a living tradition. We expect it to evolve. Recognizing the inevitability of change, the UA's bylaws mandate a review of the principles and sources that guide our tradition every 15 years to assure that they continue to be aligned with the spirit of an evolving denomination. And as with many nonprofits, we're actually kind of overdue on the 15 years. So they started a commission a couple of years ago to look again at the six sources, the current six sources and seven principles that we use, and consider how those align with an evolving denomination. Given the charge that was given to the commission, you can find that on the UUA website if you're interested, and given the current discussions within the UA, we can expect the principles to be reformulated in some significant way with this review. However, I'd be very surprised, if any of the ideas expressed by the current principles or the current sources are removed. The expression might change, but the content will remain. It's my hope that we will complete this exploration of the seven principles as they are now expressed before the report to the commission reviewing them is brought to us for consideration in a first vote at the UUA General Assembly next summer. So this is just, it's a good moment to reflect on what is it we're about as a organization, as a church, as a denomination. So as you know, the UU first principle states, Unitarian Universalist congregations affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. This principle is foundational to our identity as a denomination and as UUs. It was included in the original statement of principles and purposes drafted when the denomination was formed from the formerly separate Unitarian and Universalist associations. That happened 60 years ago. The current formulation, the way we say these, express this now, this understanding now, was adopted in 1985. The original 1961 statement declared, and I quote, "The members of the Unitarian Universalist Association unite in seeking to affirm, defend, and promote the supreme worth of every human personality," end quote. This focus on the worth of each individual has a long history within both the Unitarian and Universalist traditions. As is suggested by the name, 2,000 years of Unitarian tradition affirmed that there is only one God, a unity. Although how each of us experiences that God and the names we use for God might differ, there's only one God, and each of us is created in the image or is a manifestation of that one being. And as manifestations of the divine, each of us is necessarily worthy of dignity, of respect, and love. The universal, which is the root of universalism, refers to universal salvation. Universalists believe that all of us are worthy of salvation. They believe hell is a creation of the human imagination. They believe all of us will return to our divine source when we leave this earth. Each of us is worthy of dignity, respect, love, and salvation. Nothing we can do, nothing we can say can ever change that. As you may have noticed from the way I described this grows out of the Christian tradition, right? The Unitarians were responding to the Trinitarian Christian tradition, if you're familiar with that. Universalists were responding to, well, if you think about the Calvinists, right? There was the elect, right? And then there was all those people that we condemn, right? So that was we and God with us condemns, right? So Universalists were responding to that kind of sentiment within the early church. But it's not exclusive. These are not exclusive ideas to Christian traditions. It's what the Unitarians and Universalists grew out of. But really, they embrace and they encompass all the great religions. As someone who came independently to Universalist faith through study and prayer many years ago, I steadfastly affirm the worth and dignity of every person. And I'll say here that it's really easy to do that in the abstract. It can be really hard in the particular. Right? Our first principle calls us not only to affirm, that's the other thing to note here, we don't affirm, but to promote, right? To affirm and promote the worth and dignity of every person without exception. That includes the president, the senator, the representative, or the other politician you most love to hate. It includes the neighbor whose dog is always waking you up at night with its barking. It includes the people who cut us off in traffic or drive too slow on back roads without letting us pass. It includes the scammers who steal our hard-earned dollars with deceptive phone calls. It includes the best friend, the partner, the family member or lover who violated our trust. It includes even the shooters at the Buffalo supermarket, the Uvalde Elementary School at Sandy Hook, and too many other sites to mention. It includes the talking heads and the social media militants whose lies and hates motivate so much of the violence we experience. It includes the police officers who regularly harass, assault, and sometimes even kill rather than protect people of color. It really includes everyone. We are called to affirm and promote the worth and dignity of every person. That's really hard. And I should be clear, we are not called to absolve them of responsibility, right? Or to forget, you know, or to condone their behavior. We are not called to fail to hold people accountable. We are called to hold them in love. We commit ourselves with our principles to honoring the divine within each person, no matter how abhorrent their words or deeds. That's actually hard, right? That's a really, really challenging thing to try to live into. And it's not something we can expect to do or should expect to do perfectly, although it could be our aspiration, should be our aspiration. This morning I want to share just two practices that I think we can use to assist us on the journey to answering that challenge. One of them is to attend to our words and to attend to the conditions that they create. And the second is to cultivate self-love. I want us to think about how the words we choose to use matter, and they matter deeply. The words can help create beloved community, which is something I talked about in February or so. We talked about creation of beloved community through words and other acts. And words can create conditions that permit and even promote violence against each other. Sadly, words are all too often serve as the root of violence in our culture. Social psychologists and evolutionary biologists have demonstrated that humans are a social species. We are hardwired to protect and support other humans. Right? That really only makes sense from an evolutionary perspective. Protecting others, even at the risk of to ourselves, supports the continuance of our species. It makes sense that we'd be wired to do that. We have deeply ingrained constraints against hurting, disparaging, or killing other humans. So the first step to doing violence to others is to make them not human, to dehumanize them, to make them not in our tribe, outside our evolutionary line. And we do that with words. We cannot hurt another human being, but if we have transformed those people into something other than human, violence becomes possible and sometimes even seems necessary. That's why Putin has told the Russian people that the goal of his war is to root Nazis out of Ukraine. He doesn't portray Ukrainians as fellow humans. He makes it clear they are not people like us, they are Nazis, and they are hurting the real people, the Russians, who live in Ukraine and who we need to protect, right? You can see how that works, right? They're no longer human, right? They're Nazis, right? They're outside our tribe. And it's not just Putin. The United States, I mean, I read this, and I didn't believe it at first, I had to check it. But the United States, in 250 years of history, has never gone more than 5 years without engaging in some kind of military exploit. Not always a war, but we're a very militant country, right? And if you look at the history of that, the way that we talk about that, right, we're not warring against people. We're warring against terrorists, against jihadists, against commies, against fascists, against insurgents, against rebels, against royalists. If you go way back, it's the royalists, right? Right? We're warring against something we create with our words. And the process of dehumanization is not confined to war. It's really evident in our current political and public discourse. Partisans routinely lump those with whom they disagree or those they want to discount or disenfranchise into faceless groups that they can easily disparage. And you can think about if there's any of these words in this list that you might use. They call them racists, or they call them socialists, or elitists, or idiots, or rhinos, or libs, or bigots, or illegals, or immigrants, insurrectionists, white trash, welfare mothers, rednecks, lunatics, misogynists, fanatics, evangelical zealots, pigs, apes, dogs, and even more derogatory terms I won't bother to share here. All of these words share a common purpose. They're designed to place others outside our tribe, making them unworthy of our support and protection, easy targets for verbal, psychological, emotional, and physical violence. When it becomes acceptable to embrace a former US president who regularly refers to women as dogs, or a presidential candidate who referred to supporters of their opponent as a basket of deplorables, something is deeply wrong. To heal this hurt, we need to pay attention and learn to recognize when words are being used to dehumanize others. We need to stop ourselves from engaging in such tribalism and encourage our friends and family and neighbors to do the same. We can probably all easily recognize ways in which partisans of the other side use words to dehumanize us, right? It's easy to feel that. But it's really important that we learn to see the ways in which we use or accept the use of words to dehumanize those with whom we disagree. Look critically at how groups of people are described in the media that we consume, right? And if you discover that one of the places, your go-to places, routinely uses words that are intended to marginalize and discount and dehumanize groups of people, I would encourage you to go someplace else. Spend your time other time. You might use that time to learn more about the people with whom you disagree. Trust in their inherent worth and dignity. Right? Believe that they are, on some level, they too are a manifestation of the divine. What is it that's been in their life experience that brought them to a place that's so different from yours? Understanding and beginning, trying to understand and to see how they're a manifestation of the divine, yet they ended up someplace so different. Find their humanity. In doing that, we affirm and promote the inherent worth of dignity of every person. Above all, we need to avoid using words to make people faceless and easy to discount or disparage or discard. We need to attend to our words and the way that they're used. This is hard work. Right? It can be very uncomfortable to really sit with how we allow these things to happen in our lives, how we use words and how we allow them to be used around us and with us. To support ourselves in this work, we need to cultivate self-love. Our love for others is rooted in self-love, in love of self. And the root of hate is self-hate. You've heard me say this before, but there's a biblical injunction, a Christian injunction, to love others as we love ourselves. And I've learned to not hear that as a command to love others as we love ourselves, but as a description of what is. We love others as we love ourselves, right? We're limited by the extent to which we can find love for self. So if we really want to promote and affirm the worth and dignity of others, we have to first affirm and promote our own worth and dignity. And I suggest that it's all too easy to indulge in self-hate, and I'll give you some examples. And you can think about how we use words to disparage ourselves, right? There's no way for me to know if this is universally true, but my experience in talking to others is that for the most part, most of us entertain some kind of internal self-critical monologue, right? Some kind of self-talk that probably isn't always that helpful. For my part, I find it very easy to label myself as an idiot when I say the wrong thing and offend someone. I find it humiliating, and I can't believe I could have been so blind. Or, I can really chastise myself when I have an entire conversation with someone I run into before I realize that I've confused the person with someone else and called them by the wrong name, right? So, and it's easy to chastise myself as a moral coward when I witness something I know isn't right, or perhaps I do something, and I don't have the courage to speak up. It's easy to consider myself a failure or a loser when my plans don't work out, right? Those are all, think about all those words, right? Failure, loser, idiot, right? We're using words against ourselves now. We need a practice to counterbalance this self-undermining dialogue. And that's why there's some really, excellent practices that are about affirmations, about seeing ourselves in a different light. If we can't release ourselves from the tyranny of our own self-condemnation, we will inevitably project that condemnation onto the people around us. We will dehumanize ourselves and others and perpetuate a culture of division and distrust. Right? So there's many ways that we can counteract this. Right? A couple I want to mention coming out of spiritual traditions, which I think are useful to consider. There's certainly the mental health, there's great counseling practices, all kinds of practices coming out of mental health around affirmations. And if you do any of those practices, continue to do those. I know some of you use gratitude practices. That's another way to do that. It's to recognize, be thankful for yourself, for the things that you've done. Right? That's another way to do that. Prayers can do this. The prayers that do this typically include a few core elements, which are, at least in the Christian tradition, considered core to any prayer: recognition and adoration of the divine. The elements that they include: recognition and adoration of the divine, prayers almost always start with that. Then humbling ourselves to acknowledge our failings. And then accepting and expressing gratitude for the grace of divine forgiveness and inviting divine blessings. The arc of the prayer begins with grounding ourselves in divine presence, which enables us to confess and accept forgiveness for our shortcomings, right? It gives us that sense of something larger than that immediate, than that little box we put ourselves in, right? We're connecting to the divine. And then invites us to open up to something more, something greater than that spot we've containing ourselves in. A regular practice of such prayer can help us recognize our own divinity in spite of our shortcomings. It can help us own both our shortcomings, those places where we fall down, and the places where we are lifted up. right? The places where we really excel. Meditation can function in the same way, right? We ground ourselves in the present moment, recognizing that in this moment there is peace, right? I hope that you found some peace in the meditation we did before today's message, right? There's a way that we can find peace. We can use that small smile to kind of bring some joy, right? And when we sit in that place, thoughts of our, what we consider to be our failings might emerge, right? Might float up. There might be emotions attached to those that come forward. But when we sit in that place of peace, we can see them and we can hold them and we can let them go. Right? We don't need to attach to them. These are things that arise and we can allow to pass. Right? They don't define us. They're one small piece of our total experience. Sitting in meditation, connecting to something larger than ourselves, we can hold, or larger than what we conceive ourselves to be. I don't want to constrain ourselves here. We're much larger than we allow ourselves to be sometimes. Sitting in that space, right, we can kind of hold some of that and accept ourselves more fully. And we can call ourselves to act more mindfully in each moment. Both prayer and meditation can help us recognize and accept our humanity with equanimity while strengthening our connection to the divine. But it requires regular practice, right? And so I'd like to end this morning's message with a short meditation. I hope that my message may have helped you recognize, perhaps, the way in which you use or allow words to be used to dehumanize yourself or others. And I know that's hard, can be painful, right? But it would also be hard to live in this culture without succumbing at some points to the temptation to indulge such word use, because it's all around us. It's rampant in this culture. And if you haven't yet recognized that in your life experience, I encourage you to look more deeply. But recognizing the way we use words to support violence can be emotionally challenging. It's very challenging. It's taxing. It can cause us to forget our divinity. So let us not forget. Let us remember our own worth and dignity, our own eminence from the divine, right? We too are manifestations of the divine. So I invite you now to settle into your seat. Place your feet flat on the floor. Close your eyes if that's comfortable for you. And breathe in and out. Breathe in peace. Breathe in the energy of this space, which has been blessed by 200 years of worship. As you breathe out, allow yourselves a gentle smile. If a thought or memory of what you perceive as past failings emerges, acknowledge it without holding on to any part of it. Acknowledge any feelings that may arise, but don't hold on. Let them pass. By their nature, feelings are fluid. Let them flow. And remember to breathe. Breathe in peace. Breathe out with a gentle smile. Breathe in peace. breathe out with a smile.